could be fine, and then to be in Carolina in the morning.
In Carolina.
No one could be sweeter than McCready when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you'll hear reminiscences of life in earlier times around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll be reading excerpts from Bill Prouty's Chapel Hill, by William Prouty, whose family moved to Chapel Hill in 1919. Bill Prouty was a newspaper columnist, and the contents of these articles first appeared in the Chapel Hill Weekly and the Chapel Hill newspaper. Hi, Tin Can. There's something about seeing an old landmark dying that is similar to an old friend's passing. But I guess this is only natural when you consider that old buildings come to have personalities of their own after many years of service. It's not just an old structure of brick and mortar, wood and plaster, or of steel, or even of galvanized iron. It's more than that they're tearing down. It's shelter. It's light at night. It's protection from the rain and wind. It's people and noise and laughter, and sometimes sorrow and tears. It's memories they're smashing down and carrying away. To me, the old high school tin can was such a structure. Week before last, she sat there behind the Franklin Street Elementary School, squat, ugly, dully reflected in the scorching sun, her missing window panes looking like a crazy quilt of gray and black. Diagonally across the playing field from her stood the shiny new gymnasium, glistening in the sun, crisp, sharp, and ready for action. Her time was gone, and she looked as though she knew it. And yet, until year before last, she had served proudly her school, hosting the basketball games and intramural activities until the new gymnasium was completed. From 1926 until 1957 is a long time, over 30 years of service. She has a right to be proud. The tin can was a gift from Mayor Willie Roberson to the Chapel Hill schools. It was a magnificent gesture on the part of that kindly, soft-spoken little gentleman. Unfortunately, it was never appreciated as fully as it should have been. But then, how many gifts are fully appreciated? That was during the 1925-26 school year, and the first game of basketball was played there during that year. Calvin Birch, Rupert Bynum, Graydon Pendergraft, Jim Fowler, Auburn Wright, Bill Merritt, and Jim Weaver were some of the lucky guys on that squad. And I say lucky because before then the teams had been playing at Bynum Gymnasium, or the UNC tin can when they could sneak in one, or if not, on a dirt court that stood in the east end of the present Franklin Street Elementary School building, the only white school building here at that time, and for many years to come. Did you ever play basketball on a dirt court? If you did, well, you'll know something of how proud the high school was of that building in its early days. When first built, the tin can stood approximately where the new high school cafeteria is located. On its south side were a jungle of trees, weeds, and honeysuckle. The southwest corner of the building was up on concrete pillars, the ground falling off a little in that direction, providing a hideaway stage for some of our mischievous young actors. Without going into details, I can safely say that in no room in the whole school building was there so much learned of life as in this retreat. It was nothing to see smoke pouring from underneath there, followed by uproarious laughter. And occasionally, when everything was still, you might even have heard a cap flipped off the top of a homebrew bottle. Today, you'd call it delinquency. Scores of thrills we had at games there, agonizing in defeat, exultant in victory, but always exciting, and always agonizingly cold in raw weather, though it didn't seem to matter much. At first, they used a pot-bellied stove, but that was like emptying a bucket of water with a spoon. Later, when it was moved to its present site at the southern end of the school property, a more adequate heating plant and a blower system were installed. But it was still cold. And she's just about gone, gone to protect war surplus wares from the elements at Rockingham, a useful but unglamorous way to die. And now, only memories remain, memories that will last as long as several generations of Chapel Hill High School students. Central? Down at Brady's Restaurant, there's an antique crank-for-your-number telephone hanging on the wall. It gets a lot of eyeballing and comment from new customers, and evokes more than occasional reminiscing among the old-time habitués. Or are you old enough to remember when you had to crank your telephone before you could get anybody on the other end of the line? I do, but when I started doing it, I had to stand on a chair to reach the crank. You'd twist away at the crank and pick up the receiver from its cradle and wait until you heard a voice on the other end of the line say, "Number, please." That would be Central, who would then plug in the number you asked for with a line connected to your line and then flip a toggle switch, which would ring the bell of the phone whose number you'd wanted. Your cranking had sounded a buzzer, turned on a red light, and had dropped a white metal plate below your phone's number on Central's switchboard. When you finished your call and returned your receiver to its hook, the red light over your number on the switchboard would go off, and Central would then pull the weighted plugs from both your number and the one to which you'd been connected, and they'd plop down to their ready position on the plug panel. These were the personalized days of telephoning, generally going up into the early 20s, when almost every subscriber in our village knew Central personally. For many years here, it was Mamie Gooch Dawson. And it was quite the natural thing to pass the time of day with her before she plugged in your party's number. Central's was the best-known voice in almost any town, and the personal favors she and her colleagues all over the country did for their subscribers were so numerous that they became legendary. But these were also the days of the real party lines, differing from today's multiple hookups, in that when your assigned number of rings was activated by Central, the bells of all the other phones on your line rang also. This, as you might expect, was a signal that eavesdropping, if desired, was close to hand. And since you'd already been drawn to the phone by the ring for the other party, well... And so it was with mixed emotions that the users of old crank phones saw them discontinued in favor of the then-revolutionary dial system, which was put into operation throughout most of the country during the early to middle 20s. And as far as the layman was concerned, there was nothing essentially new in phoning from the advent of the dial systems until the early 60s, at which time was introduced the universal, or area code, direct dialing, by which means you can communicate with any phone subscriber in the country simply by dialing your own instrument. Direct distance dialing, then, is a long, long way from the old crank phones of yesteryear, and many no doubt thought that this was the ultimate in telephonic communication. But no. Now we have, well, everywhere except Chapel Hill, the touchtone service, which consists of a small panel with buttons for 1 through 0. When a button is pushed, two simultaneous musical tones are generated and flashed to the central office, where they trigger impulses that activate the bell on your phone whose number you've tapped out. The big advantages of the system are said to be speed and ease and convenience of operation, the average call taking from 2 to 5 seconds to be tapped out, as against 10 seconds for the conventional dial. And so, we old-timers have gone through the cranking and dialing days, and are now entering into the tapping era in making our calls over the telephone, from the warmly personalized to the coolly isolated method. And it's been wonderful, and getting better all the time. But remember, whether you crank for the operator and give her your long-distance number, and wait, and listen as the call goes from operator to operator, getting closer and closer to its destination, or whether you just push-button it in a matter of seconds, the wrong number is still the wrong number, and is never busy. That is, if you can get the young'uns off your party line phones long enough to even dial your party, let alone getting the wrong number. Rainy Days with Sears Roebuck. Looking back to my childhood, I believe that perhaps no event in the lives of youngsters of my generation was more eagerly anticipated than the arrival of the annual fall and winter edition of the Sears Roebuck catalog. Today, shopping centers display a vast selection of attractive merchandise, but 50 years ago, the village was an isolated community with stores of limited goods. The Sears catalog brought a magic-filled world to our very door. There were other mail-order catalogs, and good ones too, but Sears was the one to which all the others were compared by our group. Nor did the catalog's arrival escape the interested attention of our parents, who, even if they didn't plan to buy from it, figured that it would prove excellent bad-weather entertainment for three rambunctious youngsters and would help keep us from underfoot. And it did, too. I can recall whole rainy afternoons spent spread out on the living room carpet, catalogs before us, choosing equipment, after long and loud debate, of course, for the camping trip which our lively imaginations had us going on that very afternoon. And since we could have any number of great many choices of, say, bicycles, we'd naturally take the best, perhaps the Elgin motorbike, $32.45, and our only fuss would be over what special equipment, such as horns, cyclometers, and lights we'd choose for our bikes. But in the end, we'd have just the rolling stock we wanted. And for camping equipment, we'd choose the best in sleeping bags, cook stoves, hatchets, knives, rifles, and tents, and other paraphernalia which would have so burdened us that we couldn't even have packed it on our bikes, a happenstance which, had we even realized it, would have bothered us not a bit. And when we got to the campsite, there would be a beautiful lake which just cried out for the trim canoe and all the other camping accessories we'd selected before beginning our trip. But camping and cycling were not the only sports we would equip ourselves for from the Sears catalog, and with our rainy day wishful thinking. There were football, baseball, and basketball, all to be equipped with the best offered materials. And then there were the extras we would select for Dad's automobile, which would make us the envy of all the other youngsters in the block who were fortunate enough to have a dad who had an automobile. There was no limit to when and where we could and did go, and how we could be equipped for the trip, or, for that matter, what wonderful things we could have to enhance the livability of our household. But no matter how entertaining were the imaginary trips with all the best equipment and all the fine things for the home, the big thrill, and quite the reason the catalog was in your hands in the first place, was when the postman or the railway expressman, according to the size of the package, came to our home with the article we'd finally wheedled our folks into buying for us. This was the proof of the pudding and the real raison d'etre for the Sears Roebuck catalog for us young'uns. Remember, old-timer, that first bike for you from Sears? The excruciating waiting for its coming, the ecstasy of its arrival, the feverishness of its fabrication, and the exhilaration of your first wobbly pedaling? Don't forget, those were the days of no television, and only Pioneer radio equipment, and an occasional silent movie, or a rare automobile ride, and mostly unsupervised and ill-equipped games for the entertainment of young folks. And what got me thinking about how the Sears catalogs used to give us youngsters hours of spontaneous pleasure and entertainment was a copy of the 1927 edition of the Sears Roebuck catalog, which I recently purchased with nostalgic perusal in mind. And you know, it has been worth twice the price for that reason, if for no other, even if the price would have gotten you a replacement headlamp for your Model T Ford and change if you'd owned a Model T Ford with a missing headlamp back in 1927. Just as it is illustrated on the upper left-hand side of page 472 in the book. Crawfishing for Froggy Wilson. In one of his recent reminiscences in the Weekly, Chancellor Bob House paints a vivid and feeling picture of Dr. Henry Van Peters Wilson, the late great scientist and, for many years, head of the zoology department of the university. Froggy Wilson, as he was known by one and all, behind his dignified and ramrod straight back, was one of the intellectual giants who somehow showed up in Chapel Hill to change a sleepy, little-known liberal arts school into one of the leading institutions of higher learning in the country during the first three decades of this century. And though my clearest remembrances of Dr. Wilson were from meeting with him in his Davy Hall laboratory, they were not, as they sometimes were with Mr. House, encounters in, quote, an atmosphere of formaldehyde and despair, as he labored at dissecting and drawing the anatomy of frogs under the watchful and critical eye of Froggy himself, or of Critz George, his trusted laboratory assistant. Indeed, my meetings with Dr. Wilson at his lab, though permeated with the inevitable odor of formaldehyde, were usually quite happy and profitable, and on occasion brought forth a benign smile and twinkling eyes from the little professor who loved children and wasn't very good at hiding the fact. Although we stood in awe of him and were stage-struck by all that wonderful scientific apparatus, we knew we were on safe ground. We had something Froggy wanted, and for which he was willing to pay. They were crawfish, live and tail-flippin' in a beat-up old water pail, bottom stuffed with watercress in a boy's attempt to make his terrified captives as happy as possible on their last mile to their certain dissection. As Froggy transferred the crustacea from our bucket to his aquarium for further reference, he would ask us where and how we got them, and we'd tell him, more at ease with our talking, that we'd gotten them in the creek at Battle Park, or in Bolin Creek, or in Morgan Creek, and that we'd found them by overturning slime-covered rocks and catching them by hand as they tail-flipped themselves backward at amazing speeds, or that we'd found them in our cheesecloth and tree-branch seines when we pulled them from the roiled waters, churned frothy by bare legs and feet. Finished with his dipping, Froggy would pay us off. Seems to me he paid as high as a nickel apiece for the crawfish. And on rare occasions, he would give one of us a pat on the head for a job well done. And we'd take off over the campus for a 10-cent ticket to a matinee at the Pickwick Theater, or a bag full of sugar-coated raisin buns from Bill Neal's bakery, or for some trinkets from the hardware store. Having read Mr. House's story about Froggy Wilson, and soon afterward having heard a lady say that she surely wished she could afford a portable, but quite expensive, miniature television set for her youthful son to play with, I couldn't help but contrast the present times and those of my youth, and of our comparatively simple diversions and pleasures. It's an old and ageless argument, of course, the comparing of one generation to another, and will never be settled. But I can truthfully say that if the choice were left to me, I'd still take the crawfish and the wonderful world of personal, youthful adventure, and of standing in awe of Froggy Wilson and of an occasional pat on the head from the great man himself, instead of today's myriad of diverting and fascinating gadgets. Somehow television adventure seems a little too easy to come by, and not nearly as much fun for youngsters as the real thing would be. You cannot watch television and wade up mysterious creeks at the same time. Seems to me that television is more for us old-timers, whose growing cynicism has all but obviated among us any capacity for adventure in the first person, than it, and all the other fancy gadgets of the day, is for youths, whose need for personal experience adventure is as great today as it ever was. Oh well, to each man, his own generation was of course the most fortunate, one of nature's more subtle compensations for having to look back at all on one's youth, no matter under what circumstances it might have been spent. The Big Snow. The other morning, Mr. Wallace Caldwell, the history professor, and I met out in front of the NC cafeteria, and he reminded me that in all my reminiscences in this column, he had not remembered my mentioning that the first thing the students here used to do when it snowed was to strip down their bunks and use the springs as sleds, often tying them behind automobiles which towed them around town at breakneck speeds. I had to own that, though I didn't recall having written about bedspring sleds, I certainly remembered them zooming around the village's roads, and also that I had wished at that time I could have bummed a ride on one of these improvised sleighs. I promised Mr. Caldwell that the next time it snowed, I would surely write something about the bed sleds of yesteryear. Meanwhile, all this talk about sleds only served to remind me that we've had no snow this winter, and that I had been missing it without even knowing what I'd been missing. And here it is, almost spring. I know, I'm pushing it a bit. And there hasn't been a sign of a snow in these parts as yet. So perhaps now's the time, Mr. Caldwell. There's nothing in the world that turns man into boy, with the possible exception of the Christmas office party, as completely as a fine snow. This, of course, applies only to those adult persons who live in climes where there's never too much snow. In the latter case, the grown-ups have had too much experience with shoveling snow off their walks and stalling their cars and mushing through the slosh to get really enthused over the coming of the beautiful white stuff. But in this sometimes yes and sometimes no snow country, the first flurry, as well as each succeeding flurry of snow, brings a special thrill to all youngsters, grown or growing. Immediately, thoughts of sledding, whether on store-bought or bedspring sleighs, and or snowballing, and of other great fun pop into our minds and won't leave us until the last flake flutters down, becoming a watery spot on the too warm earth. How clean and cheerfully silent are the flakes of a good snow as they descend on the earth too fast to be consumed by the hungry ground, a myriad of tiny dancing specks, black against the low-hanging gray sky. How deliciously refreshing the flake's cool kiss on upturned faces. How embracing the keen, freshly washed air. Lest we give up completely on having a snow hereabouts this year, however, perhaps we'd better go back a few years to what was one of the village's biggest snows in recorded time. For that one came on the first day of March in the year of 1927. The Weekly of Friday, March 4th, headlined the story. Great snowstorm descends upon village, paralyzing traffic, drifts pile high. The paper's lead story began, Chapel Hill was buried Wednesday under what the old-timers said was the deepest snow since 1899. Some of them go even further back than that to find a parallel. The rapidity of the fall was amazing. The flakes did not begin to come down until after supper Tuesday. Next morning, the village awoke to find snow from 18 inches to 2 feet deep on level spaces and from 3 to 5 feet deep in the drifts. How well I remember that storm, how my brothers and I blazed a puffing, struggling hour's trail up Pittsboro Road from Westwood to the village, how our next-door neighbor, Howard W. Odom, got his wife's sister home from the Carborough train station after a 3-hour tussle on a borrowed tractor. What a wonderfully long weekend we had from school, Wednesday through Sunday. And sleds, 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 many of them of the bedspring variety. And now, when the leaden skies hang low and the smoke from the chimneys, don't see much anymore, do you, hangs close to the ground, I turn a wistful thought back to March 1927. The big snow and all the thrills it brought. And for the life of me, I cannot remember the sloshy slush, the sooty mush that time and warm air made out of that winter wonderland. Only the fun we had remains in my memory. There must be others like myself, still looking for another big snow. And if this shows that we're still youngsters at heart, then that also is okay with old Bill.
The fundamental things apply as time goes by. As time goes by.
Stroll through the Arboretum. I can ride by the old university campus just so many times before the urge to park my conveyance and take a walk through a section of it compels me to do just that. The other afternoon, I ambled through the W.C. Coker Arboretum. It was a delightfully nostalgic walk. My informal introduction to the Arboretum was at a tender age, and very sudden. You see, it was in the early 20s, and our family had just moved from the old Seton Barbie house in downtown Chapel Hill to the newly built University Houses in Park Place on Hooper Lane, and the straightest bicycle ride from our new home to our old and other sadly missed downtown haunts was up Hooper Lane, across Battle Lane, along the back of President Harry Chase's home, then up the senior walk to McCorkle Place, right through the Arboretum. And being sort of a roamy young'un, I sometimes pedaled this route in lieu of scheduled homestead chores and or permission. And on one of these occasions, speeding home in order to lessen my imminent reprimand, my bike pedal somehow got hooked on the cedar post in the middle of the path of the northeast gate, and I soared over the handlebars and scudded across Raleigh Street, it was unpaved then, on face, hands, and belly. And I limped home, bruised and bleeding, and pushing my battered bike. But all was not lost, for at the first sight of me, my mother's compassion pushed aside her anger, and no errant youngster ever folded into a more comforting embrace. As I said, my introduction to the Arboretum was very sudden, but it nonetheless led to a lasting friendship. The young folks of my generation delighted in its cool, shaded walks, its spacious greenswards for lively games, picturesque hideaway for cops and robbers' antics, and for that lost-in-the-middle-of-town feeling it gave to the adventuresome youngsters among us. And there was camping, well, sleeping out at any rate, with many of us spending our first tented nights in some secluded spot in the Arboretum, to the delight of ourselves, our dogs, and the plentiful mosquitoes, which took the whole business to their liking. And as we grew older, we retained our love for this beautiful place, making occasional visits there as students of university botany classes, and perhaps even more often as researchers into the wondrous ways of winsome young womenfolk. In 1903, Dr. W. C. Coker, professor of botany at the university, was named director of the Arboretum by President Francis P. Venable, and according to Lewis Round Wilson in his University of North Carolina 1900-1930, Coker, quote, brought into being a garden of color and loveliness, which has been an unending delight to residents of Chapel Hill, to the students, and to thousands of visitors who have made pilgrimages to Chapel Hill to walk its paths, breathe its fragrance, and feel the spell of beauty which it lays upon them. And so, by transforming, as Mr. Wilson put it, an uninviting crayfish bog into a thing of abiding loveliness, Coker wrought a work which will last forever in the memories of us local old-timers, and the university students of our years, and the couples whose romances were welded there will always testify as to the romantic atmosphere of the place, as will those lovers who somehow escaped Cupid's erratic arrow thrusts. And what has been remembered by us will not likely be forgotten by the generations of students yet to come, and the hippies and the freaks will recall this soft green oasis as a convenient place for their sleep-ins, as will the students for parking their autos on the Arboretum's east sidewalk in order to pick up their dates in the women's dormitories across the way. And also, really, the beauty and the restfulness of this isolated little spot, set down among the hurry and ado of a bustling campus, will long remain in the memory of anyone who strolls unhurriedly through its beckoning, verdant peacefulness. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Following the broadcast, this episode is readily available as a podcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.
Is the hand a land and time for only a day? Why, make a wish and hear what I say. Nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.